And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm excited about our guest. Good friend Chase Kletzy is coming back on the show, and she's got all kinds of new and interesting things to talk about. And before her, though, we have Alejandro Rojas coming up with the news and just a couple things. And tomorrow morning, I get up early and I start heading north to Shag Harbor. So I'm going up there for the 50th anniversary celebration, and I'm going to be interviewing, hopefully live, some of the witnesses, such as Laurie Wickens and a few others. And that's going to happen this coming Saturday on the 28th, and that's at 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can see it right here on YouTube or on our website, Podcast UFO. If you're supporting the show, I want to thank you very much. If you can't support the show but want to listen to the whole show free, there's a couple ways to do that. First of all, podcastufo.com every Wednesday at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Also on our YouTube channel, you can subscribe to that. And we are also Thursday as a podcast on the Dark Matter Digital Network, and that's 10 to midnight. And we're also on Outworld Fleet Radio that Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's enough for me, Alejandro. How are you doing?
I am doing well. And I'm sorry I'm ignorant of this, but every time we do the video, you know, I watch you, and you have this green drape behind you, and I'm sure there's like that space or some other planet. What is it that's usually behind you?
Oh, well, right now for the last...
I never see the YouTube.
I know. For the last two shows, I have Paul Benowitz UFO lights behind me.
Oh. You know,
yeah. They look pretty spooky.
Creepy.
Yeah. I'm just showing them. I'm moving over so everybody can see them. But, yeah, I have to change
it. I can see more of the drape.
I thought of putting something that moved, but that would be very distracting.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, yeah. They need to listen to pay attention to this great information.
True, true. So how's everything going?
I am doing well, keeping busy with the Congress. We have tons of people registering, and if you don't mind me telling people,
they've
got to register by the end of the month if they want to get the major big discount, so the price goes up quite a bit. And they can go to UFOCongress.com, of course, to see a lot of the speakers. So we have almost half of them listed, but even more important than that, Chase Kletzy will be there. She'll hopefully be helping, you know, people at the registration desk. And then you're going to be there as well, wandering around and just being a cool dude like usual.
I want to do something like real important, like, I don't know, try to think of something.
Okay, like,
I don't know.
Some kind of top hat
alien
and
watch.
Outfit.
Yeah.
Where you like, tell people, hello and welcome, kind of do like the whole.
Hello and welcome to, yeah, that's a good. Oh, also, I am going to be doing, hopefully it'll work out. I'll be able to do another live show from there as I've done every year. But you know what? I'm going to accommodate you this year a little bit better because I'm not on a radio station. So I can work around the schedule and just let everyone know. Cause I always do it during the buffet, right? The meet and greet.
Yeah, I know. I'm always running around busy and then you're over here, you know, I've got a conference to put on and you're over here, but I need to do my radio show. Help.
Yeah. So I'm going to change that this year, make it a little easier for you.
Good. Good. Yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Work around our schedule so we don't have to work around yours.
Finally. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
So what's going
on? So the news. I posted a cool story about Prince Philip. So I didn't realize this. I hadn't done this before. But the Sun, and this is the news I wanted to talk about, from the Devil's Tower event that unfortunately I was excited because Chase was going to be able to go to that, but she couldn't make it. So I didn't get to hang out with her there. But all of us other researchers, the Sun, the UK tabloid, which we're always usually typically making fun of because they don't always do the best work. They've written some really good stories about the different talks there. They wrote about mine, Travis Walton's. And then today they wrote about Chuck Zukowski and Debbie Ziegelmeyer, who talk about this 37th parallel. And it's kind of exciting. I talked to Chuck recently, and they're doing – like they did a book with Ben Masaryk, and they're going to do a movie. And I guess Robert Downey Jr. is excited about it, so they might have some famous people playing, you know, Chuck and Debbie, who's fun because if you know them, they're great people. But that's going to be pretty interesting to see who they have play each of those people. Assuming this movie goes through, but so far so good. So that's some cool stuff that's on the Sun that you can see on the website. Otherwise, other news. One of the stories they wrote about was really cool, and we haven't talked about this since your last show, and that was Mark D'Antonio, and I think he shared this story on your podcast, but what's cool about this is he hasn't shared it with the mainstream yet, and this is essentially kind of the first mainstream media posting of this story that's been written. So Mark D'Antonio, MUFON's photo analyst, used to have a top secret clearance. He doesn't anymore, not that he lost it. He just isn't doing that work anymore that needed it. And this is cool too, because I've always been interested in Chase's response, because she has some connection with this type of thing. But when Mark was working on these models, they had him, he got to take a ride in a Navy nuclear sub. And while he was in that sub, the sonar, like the guy at the sonar said, fast mover, fast mover. And, he said he was clocking something going at something like 200 knots. And, but they didn't really let Mark know much about it. When he asked the commanding officer about it, the commanding officer said, Mark, are you enjoying your ride? And Mark said, sure. Yeah, this is great. And he said, well, let's keep it that way. So essentially, shut up. So later on, he was working on these programs, and he talked to another officer, and he said, hey, tell me about the fast mover program. And the guy told him, I can't tell you about that, which led Mark to believe that there really is some sort of program, which I think people will be excited about, because he's often typically kind of considered a skeptic, since he hasn't found a UFO photo, essentially, that he's like. You and I talk about this quite a bit. So that was a really cool story. That was another great story that the Sun had. So that's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Otherwise, another big story this week is the Russians. So there were some odd photos taken in Russia, in Armenia, and some of the countries around there. And for those of us like you and I who are used to this, we can identify what it is. And it was a missile. Uh-huh. And essentially, these missiles, what they'll do is they just swerve weird, or they can spin out and create these giant spirals like they did in Norway. And, and a lot of people, I don't know if you still get hate mail every time we talk about this, but and it was Mark D'Antonio who burst my bubble on this one. I'm like, what? That can't be a missile. And he explained to me how, and then he showed me other evidence of how this has happened in the past. In fact, there are times where you can go on YouTube and see these missiles coming out of a sub, then going haywire and just spinning out of control, and you see this spiral effect happening. So when it happens at space, it's even more extraordinary. I remember there's a big one in L.A. where lots of stars and stuff had seen it, and a big portion of the sky was covered by the gas in this thing. So
that was
really
a failed,
cool.
Failed missile launch on that one.
Yep. And failed missile launch.
Yeah, that it's the upper atmosphere, and like you said, low space where these things really look totally amazing. And I really, really get why someone would think it would be something out of this world. You know, it just doesn't appear like, that could be.
It does. It looks wild. And when it's, like you said, in the upper atmosphere, it looks humongous. So, but it's just gases that are reflecting the sunlight and stuff like that. So, finally, this is really cool, too. I think just because I've been kind of, and you've probably have been privy to this story, there's a guy named Philip Mantle in the UK, and he's been talking about this guy Spyros Malaris for quite some time, the guy who alleges to have, created the bodies when it came to the alien autopsy film.
Right.
Well, a lot of people have doubted it, and really, Philip Mantle's kind of been carrying this all on his own. But finally, because his Spiros Malaris has been like hesitant to talk publicly, and so he's been kind of elusive. But finally, he's been talking to the major media, and he's been admitting, okay, yeah, I'm the guy, and describing in detail how he created and hoaxed those videos. And he says, you know, which is one of the reasons he didn't come out, he is really embarrassed. He did not realize it would get so huge as it has. And so he says he feels really bad about it. It was a joke, but now it's turned into this huge thing. And of course, as he predicts in his story, even though he's come forward and talked about, even in very minute detail, how he created all of these different things. Sure enough, when I posted it on Facebook, you know, people are like, I don't believe this. This is a cover up. He's lying. So,
yeah. That's what
welcome
you get.
To ufology.
Yeah. Now, he's not the one that made the $200,000 or whatever it was from it, was he?
No, there's a guy there who owned it, and I can't remember his name right now. And if you go to my Facebook post on this, I posted a couple follow-up stories because Philip Mantle's a contributor at openminds.tv. And so he's written about this and other things at length. And he wrote about how the owner, and he uses his name, and I can't remember his name, tried to provide film as proof that these were real. But the film he provided, some of it was not from the right time period and was not correct. Some of it was from the right time period but were copies. But the problem was all of this film he provided, none of it had any of the alien autopsy stuff on it. He said, oh, this is from another part of the film.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, so but he would not provide a part of the film that had, you know, what people were interested in, so that could be tested, which is just all signs of, you know, this guy trying to trick everybody. And he did trick people, and he made a lot of money off of it.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, I've every once in a while someone will send me something about the alien autopsy. I remember when it went viral on TV. This was, I don't know, what was that, the 1990s sometime?
Yeah, sometime in the 90s. I can look it up here.
Yeah, and it was, I remember seeing it and thinking, wow, you know, that, and I wasn't even really talking about UFOs back then or anything, but I saw that clip and I thought, wow, is that even possible? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But think of the probably millions of people out there that think that was a real deal.
Yeah, Ray Santilli was the guy's name in 1995.
Okay. Yeah.
Was when the video came out. Yeah, it was produced by Bob Kiviat, who's someone I actually was speaking to today about. He's still doing UFO shows, and Kiviat is he's really into UFOs. He's a TV producer. He's done a lot of some of the stuff that people would recognize, but this was one where, yeah, everybody kind of got, a lot of people got duped, but then again, a lot of people made money too.
Yeah, right, right. So is that it for today?
That's it for now.
All right. So we'll be back next week. Thanks, man.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Take care. All right. Our guest is Chase Kalitsky, and we've had her on. I think she was one of the early people on our show way back. And I always enjoy having her on so much. And she has an amazing background. If you're listening live or you're listening to this as a podcast, you can check out her bio in the show notes. And she was schooled as a private investigator, and she joined MUFON back in 1996 and was selected as part of the STAR team manager at the time. Anyway, glad to have her back. As usual, Chase, welcome to the show again.
Thanks so much for having me, Martin. You know, I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, I know it's been, I can't remember how long it's been, but it's, oh, I know the last time you were on is when we were in Phoenix. You were at the round table in Phoenix. So that's going back. But always
my
fun
favorite
to have
conference.
You. And I know, everyone wants to hear the triangle story, but you have told that a billion, million times. So we're going to be talking, we may talk about that if we actually run out of stuff to talk about toward the end of the show. But for now, what's been going on lately? You're into all kinds of things you've been doing.
Yeah, it's really a great time to be a UFO investigator. And, well, actually, if you don't know what it is, I'll go look. So if it's a legit report or sighting or event. I just enjoy being out, boots on the ground, and, you know, just digging in and getting some of these mysteries solved one case at a time.
Right. And when we were talking briefly before the show, you mentioned that there's a new model of investigation. Can you talk about that? This is for MUFON, right?
Yeah. Coming back to MUFON, Jan Harzan had talked to me about, you know, he had an idea about a team of people that he could rely on for some of the cases that don't quite fit the CMS model or the case management. And that's where the public can file the reports. So we call that CMS. And not everything fits in that little box and things that MUFON is interested in. Well, he didn't have a team that could work on those or a system set up to take that without, you know, just asking a couple investigators already in MUFON. But, you know, our state directors and field investigators are already so overworked, it seems. We get so many reports. So he asked me to design this, and it was kind of a headquarters team. And when he told me what he thought his needs were or what kind of team he was looking at, I immediately thought that I could design a new investigation model that hasn't really been done before, especially in MUFON. MUFON works typically in pairs, and investigators start with background. And I kind of thought, if we're going to be dealing with high-profile witnesses, whistleblowers, you know, stories of high national security interest, hackers type things, then we need a high performance team. So I developed that, and we work as a task force, no different than a police department that would have their regular police, you know, out there handling the everyday needs that cannot be dropped. But then you have this special unit that can come in and handle the big things that take extra time and a little more scrutiny and, you know, a lot of different leads going in all different directions. So that's what I've done is I designed the special assignment team to handle that. But I love this investigation model because it's turned out to be so successful. We even incorporated a reporter and a correspondent. So it's just really been, you know, to kind of keep up with all our information and keep things organized, because as a task force, we go in, everybody contributes, everybody's throwing stuff on the table, you know, we're throwing things up on the board and making timelines and making things work. So I'm really proud of this, this team that's, you know, brand new and move on. It's actually 3 years old now. I kind of can't believe it because I still feel like we're new.
And, now, some of the complaints you hear about in MUFON are, you know, things like not being able to access the data, you know. Do you think any of that will ever change or what, you know, do people discuss that, say, you know, the board or, you know, where does that go?
They do. It's always a concern, and it comes up quite a bit because Jan – sometimes we're aggravated at this because he focuses on, you know, everything that comes across his desk. So whether somebody has a complaint or an idea, he gives it the same amount of attention as everything else. And it is a complaint. I think what most people don't understand is when we're asking for information for witnesses, we can't just put all that information out for the public to see because, you know, their address is on it and, or they might be talking about their minor children in part of the report. But it's also all their contact information. It's just, so if we try to leave that out, and then we have the investigators, and sometimes we're digging into things that would reveal that information. So the investigator notes kind of can't make those public either. So we're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, how to be as transparent as people would like us to be, and yet it's not an option because of protecting our witnesses. There's just no way, you know, most of my investigation notes could never be made, you know, public to anybody. However, we do have people that, you know, will call in to MUFON and want more details on certain cases. And of course, he and Roger Marsh will immediately send you to the FI and the state director. So we're trying to be as transparent as possible, but we're dealing with, you know, private people and sometimes extraordinary reports that they wanted us to have the information so that their event was documented, but they don't want to hear about it anymore. You know, they want to wash their hands and move on.
Yes, and I know how important anonymity is for witnesses. Otherwise, you know, it wouldn't work. You know, there's a lot of people that just would not make a report if they knew that their name was going to get out there. Some people don't care, but for those people that do, you'd lose all those. You know?
Right. Or what about the people that don't care because they didn't fully understand the type of attention they would get and then now want it taken down? But it is a discussion. It's an issue that is consistently reexamined. Is there anything new we can provide, anything new we can do with, you know, new avenues that we have like YouTube or, you know, so it is a concern, and MUFON takes a lot of hits for it, which I think is unfair. Because the only reason these reports aren't out there is to protect the very people asking for them.
You know, I read a lot of Roger Marsh does a lot of writing for Alejandro's website, Open Minds TV. And I read those reports, and a lot of times I wonder, you know, it's either closed or it's still open or whatever. But I always wonder the follow-up. You know, is there any way at all to find out what happens to, like, one of the major cases as far as the investigation at all?
Absolutely. Just contact Jan through an email or a phone call. What separates MUFON from most organizations that investigate anomaly is we have a business office. That's amazing. A fully staffed business office that focuses. Yeah, it focuses directly on, you know, the business of having, you know, these operations where the investigators are getting the training that they need. And, you know, now we have MU, everything's online, MUFON University. There's courses in astrology. And, you know, our days of sniffing dirt are over, Martin, because there's a lot of really high-tech stuff going on, and MUFON really holding on desperately to that scientific method, which some people are critical of. And yet, it's the only way we're going to meet admissibility. So for us to ever hit that burden of proof for any kind of public or the science, we're holding on to the very strict protocols that we take hits for. I get it, guys. We all want to do the, you know, fringe out here, and they'll let you do that as well, but just not in MUFON. We have to stick with a scientific agenda. And, you know, but it's an ever-changing world.
I think that was some of what the complaints were for the symposium this last year that was a little far out there, a lot of the speakers. So I'm sure you heard a little bit of that flack, right?
We did. And I'll admit something to you that a lot of people don't know. Each year, Jan picks, you know, people that he feels are best suited to, you know, maybe help with speakers and to help with some of the conference material. And last year I was part of that team, and that kind of helped, like, who do we bring in? Who do we have? And of course, my first words were Richard Dolan and Michael Schratt. And I like to stay very science minded, but And I have to tell you that I did make a comment. I was not happy, and I did not think it was a good idea to bring in a couple of the speakers. And I won't mention them because I think it's going to be obvious. But and I was really very defiant about that. And then it hit me when Jan explained, but, you know, Chase, we can't always just present our side or the side we just want the people to know. Why don't we give the public the entire story, which also includes this other end? And I thought, you know what? All these TV shows or, you know, blogs and, you know, all the information we're getting out here, they typically set up so that they're telling you what's going on and what you need to believe, and this is what happened and done. I love that Jan stepped out of the box and he took a lot of heat for it, except it was the biggest symposium in history. It tripled last year in numbers, you know, in revenue. And I think it was a stroke of brilliance that he presented the whole case and let the public decide this time. These are the best witnesses on both sides. What do you guys think? Because it's a symposium. And it's also our fundraiser. You know, everybody hates to bring money in ufology, but somebody's got to pay the bills and the office space and the, you know, and it's our fundraiser. Why wouldn't we try to create the kind of list that would give us the numbers we had last year? So it, for a business end to move on, it was brilliant, but he's still taking hits for, giving these people a little stage time. And I get that.
Yeah.
But I also understand, even I found myself going in there because, I only knew a part of what some of these speakers that I didn't care for. I only knew a little bit of their story because I shut down so quickly. Let me hear all of what they have to say. I came out with the same opinion, but at least I fairly gave it some weight.
Right. Oh, you know, Jan is a smart guy. There's no doubt about it. So there, you know, the MUFON took a little bit of other hits this year. How has, as far as you know, I don't know how much you know about the inner workings, but what is the membership going like?
We did take some hits, and it's unfortunate. You know, some we kind of asked for. And some were unfair. And I think it was, I call it kind of almost a sifting. You know, every few years in ufology, you know, something riles up and, you know, people leave because, you know, they're disgusted with it or whatever. And in this case, we had a couple incidences that caused, some of our veteran ufologists that have been doing this for 40 and 50 years versus my little 25. But, you know, to leave MUFON, and yeah, it kind of hurt. It stung. And you know, nobody likes to lose some of our greats, or some of the people that have really movers and shakers. And yet at the same time, we're not going to affect change or kind of keep people honest. We all know that I left because I caught a few people with their hands in the cookie jar. And when I left, I called them out by name. They're not there anymore. We can't fix things by just quitting. And I really do think that MUFON has to change in the direction it's going to remain viable and visible and relevant. And yet we have people that, you know, just don't think that, you know, everything should stay the same, because why are we falling into that trap? And, you know, so it's a business decision at this point. And if anybody thinks that, you know, ufology is not a business, or, you know, if you have a paranormal team, hasn't been in the field that long, it's very competitive. It's very tumultuous at times. But the good news is a few of the losses we took stung. There were a couple that, you know, don't let the door hit you on the butt on the way out, buddy, because you know, how dare you have an opinion and say something so egregious, especially publicly. We don't need people like you in our organization. So some needed to go, others stung. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, you know, we have remarkable people coming into MUFON by the droves. And some of these positions that we were really stuck thinking, how are we ever going to fill those shoes? And we did. So,
wow.
You know,
MUFON's
on. Yeah, and MUFON's on solid ground. You know, it's an organization that even if there were four people out here and one guy at the office or manning the phones, MUFON's going to exist. And I haven't always been a fan of MUFON. Everyone knows this. I was very public in my exit and why I left, and I called out the people I caught with their hand in the cookie jar, and it took them a little time. I think the hit that MUFON took with the social media incident, without getting into names and all that, we'll just call it the social media incident. You know, everybody clearly saw what was going on. Obviously, he wasn't going to get to stay. But I really thought that people jumped on it way too quick. This is an international organization that has to worry about being sued, lawyers, you move too quickly before you know the facts. I really like that we had people that insisted on talking to him through the process of elimination, kind of, you know, and bringing him in. So, you know, because there's legalities, you know, when you have an organization this big.
Sure. Absolutely.
And people just demanded, you know, Jan needs to fire him right this minute. Well, we all knew it was coming, but we had to follow the rules and the law. So
yeah, you really do. Yeah, your target. Now, what about Peter Davenport's New Fork, National UFO Reporting Center? Does he work with MUFON? I know I had him on the show, but I can't remember if I asked him that question. As far as investigations.
He is a great partner, and every once in a while, I don't believe he's in MUFON and working with us directly, but we have such a good relationship with Peter. I love Peter Davenport.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
I think, yeah, and he's one of our biggest heroes. I mean, that man has been manning our national UFO reports for decades all by himself.
Right.
What a pioneer and just a remarkable man. I'm very fond of him.
Yes.
We have a good relationship with him, and there are many times he'll call Roger Marsh and say, hey, I got this really good case, and I've talked to the witnesses, and they would like to talk to an investigator. So he will call MUFON and talk to Jan or Roger or Steve Hudgens, and the Steve Hudgens is the DOI, Director of Investigations, and get an investigator. So, yeah. And it's a good partnership. MUFON works with a lot of people.
Yeah. Now, the only thing, the poor guy, though, is getting pranked. I don't know if you heard that.
Yes.
Prank calls. It's really too bad. And hopefully that'll stop.
Yeah.
Because he's, I think he's now using the answering machine, so it doesn't happen anymore. Or happens less. Anyway, so what have you been up to? I know you're up to all kinds of things. I want to hear what's going on.
It's so crazy. I love what I'm doing, and it's just a great time to be out here for a lot of reasons. The investigation opportunities have increased to the point where we can actually work with scientists, and we're working with legitimate independent labs, and we're really able to dig in a little further. And of course, I have done something. Not much has happened with it yet, but remember the citizens hearing for disclosure?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I thought Steve Bassett was amazing, and that whole event was so brilliant. And I remember sitting there in the audience, and I watched these, former senators and Congress men and women come up on a Monday morning, and they're sitting there very politely because they got paid a lot of money to be polite.
That's
and
right.
I heard that they got paid. Yeah, well, and of course, this is the unfortunate side effect, is these things cost money. I mean,
yes.
Ufologists were like, why would you spend that on them? This is why, because things like this happen. But I watched these guys, and by Wednesday, you've got Senator DeGaulle going, I agree, we need to open those files. What I'm witnessing is when we have policymakers, lawmakers, or people that really affect national change, big things that we need done in ufology, that we need their help in declassification, or getting through a different door, or having the endorsement of this senator to talk to somebody on this top secret base. What I saw was they can be convinced with the proper witnesses and the proper material. And like I said, by Wednesday, these people, and then you've got Kirkpatrick over there saying, oh, I agree. There's a cover up. Well, if they can be convinced because of our evidence and testimony, we have an opportunity, a real one, if we present our information correctly. So last year, I started paperwork to become an official registered, no joke, my name's on the books, I have an ID, it's on my website, I even copied it so everyone knew this was a legit lobbyist for the UFO movement. And Steve Bassett was such an inspiration because we can fill out all the FOIAs and how many times we're rejected or they say they can't find them. And on some of the cases that we really cannot ignore or let fall into a waste paper basket, we need partnership. So we need to start utilizing these avenues. So I actually became a UFO lobbyist.
Oh, I
officially,
heard that. Yes. Ah.
Officially.
Uh-huh. Wow.
So
now there's two.
Yes. And, Steve, he's about the disclosure, and I'm more about science and technology. And when I talk to them, I don't ask them for disclosure because I kind of have a different attitude about DC. I don't think the best way for me or, some of us to get the agenda we want done by going up and we want it all and we demand and, you know, we want disclosure right now. I just don't believe it's going to happen. So how do we get what we need, to further, you know, further help our witnesses or, you know, to get the information to the public? Well, we almost have to play their rules. But when we do play their rules, we're winning. Because the citizens' hearing came out and what we got was confirmation. And I think a lot of people missed that. And the confirmation was when, the Rendlesham, they were talking about the Rendlesham incident where John Burroughs wasn't getting the proper attention from his VA benefits because they wouldn't admit anything happened in Rendlesham. These policymakers were so offended that this veteran, retired sergeant, couldn't get medical over something that happened to him while he was on duty, helped him. And they had to admit something happened in Rendlesham because he now has gotten his full benefit. They've done right by him. That's confirmation. That is a huge step for the government and the senator to get involved. So I'm looking at all these things that are happening and knowing we can no longer ignore mainstream science or even our politicians. If we have Podesta emailing Hillary Clinton about the UFO issue, we have a chance, guys, and we need to step on it now. We can't wait and do this in 2-3 years. We have to do it now.
You know, it just reminded me this conversation that I saw George Knapp post on Facebook that he's going to have Tom DeLonge on in the next 2 weeks or so, and he's live on the air. He's going to finally make that announcement he's been promising for like a year or something like that. When you mentioned John Podesta.
Yeah, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed because, Martin, I'm not sure how you felt, but when, you know, Tom DeLonge first came out, I'm thinking, I don't know if I'm buying this. Mm-hmm. You know, a rock star, you know, why not a Linda or Richard Dolan who's been out here? How does he get that privilege and access? I just really wasn't buying it. And I thought it was more, you know, his little stunts or whatever. You know, he's an entertainer. Until friggin' WikiLeaks leaks the emails and we find out this guy's legit. And Podesta's talking about Tom DeLonge and the meetings. And I was just like, oh, this is good stuff. So I just wish Tom would embrace more of, you know, the legitimate part of our community and work with us more, because I think he'd get, you know, some of his background faster if he does that, but he seems to be doing all right.
Yeah, there's almost like a disconnect. I understand what you're saying, like a go-it-alone type of thing. You know, I'm not going to say that he thinks himself too important, but perhaps he may think the celebrity part is the what's opening the doors, and he's just going to keep move forward as he has been. You know, I don't really know. This is all speculation.
I think you're right. And unfortunately, he's never been part of really the UFO community. And I think he doesn't know what he's missing, because to partner with the kind of historical information that would just strengthen his knowledge base, which is going to make you a better debater and a better negotiator for some of the stuff that he can affect in D.C. But, you know, again, you know, and a celebrity got in the door when the rest of us haven't. We have to pay attention to why why. Was it his approach, or is it really celebrity? And it would stink if it was celebrity, because we have so much more to offer.
I think there's some type of power in that. And also, you know, I mean, there's power in someone that has a lot of money. You know, that being said, there it comes. I know Chris Mellon is working with him, and, you know, the Mellon Family Bank. I mean, you can't get more powerful than that unless you're Bill Gates or someone. But so, yeah, they've got a lot going. We'll see what happens, and we'll see what happens with George Knapp in just a couple of weeks.
I'm glad George is on it, though. I like George. I trust George.
Yes.
What I don't trust is who Tom DeLonge's getting in bed with. Like you said, you have these major banks. You know, are they using him for disinformation? You know, we've seen this happen historically throughout the UFO field. when, you know, even the Benowitz case with Doty, Richard Doty,
right,
you know, that absolutely decimates this guy. And, you know, on a documentary being filmed, he's almost bragging and giggling about how silly this man was and how easy he was, you know, and I want to throat punch him. You know, I hope I never see this man at a conference because I'm so offended by what he's done and ruining people's lives. But then he did the same thing with Linda and then openly admitted that they had a campaign for disinformation. So unfortunately, with Tom DeLonge going in not only solo, but keeping, you know, getting in bed with some of these, you know, big money and interest, I'm not sure. It depends on what he has to say if I'm going to buy it hook, line, and sinker.
Well,
we've been here before.
Yeah, going back to, I didn't mean to lead you in that direction when it came to Chris Mellon, because Chris Mellon thinks there's something going on. He used to work for the Department of the DOD, and he had the highest level of clearance, and so he definitely thinks something's going on. And
Right. But it's this money behind, and, you know, you're using people
that, I see what you're saying.
You know, don't have, you're right. It's, you know, even the government bringing him in, it's almost, it depends on what he has to say. I would feel better if some of this discussion was done with a few of our people, and meaning like a Richard Dolan or, you know, somebody of his caliber that would not only understand the history, but would ask for vetting. You know, I'm not going to just look at a file. I'm going to want to vet that DOD document. And I'm not sure Tom DeLonge would do that. I'm not saying he isn't. It's just these were going to be my concerns until I hear what he has to say. And I hope we're all jumping up and down.
Right. I know we've, like you said, I think it's pretty funny. Every few years, there's some type of fiasco. We can go back to the Roswell slides and, you know, a number of different things that have happened over the years. And, you know, I think the one that died out was the three-fingered alien there that looked like it was covered in plaster. We're not hearing anything about that anymore.
Well, and Gaia is still putting out that they're further testing and there's more information, but that DNA test was leaked. It was leaked and... You know, even I posted it because once it was already on socials, I'm like, oh, I'm going to go ahead and post it. Because the other thing I was fascinated with was it was the same paleo DNA lab up in Canada that, you know, I've used for the Star Child skull and that we've used for the elongated skulls in Peru, that L.A. Marzulli is leading that investigation and expedition team. But I'm part of it. We've taken over 300 DNA samples out of Peru. And having these tested, and in fact, we're starting to get some results in, but that's going to have to be announced. LA wants to hold a press conference in Texas, and because this is pretty good. But, you know, it's the same lab, and this is a legit scientific lab. I don't use UFO analysts. I kind of feel like that's the prosecution trying to use their own experts and win a case and it be balanced and fair. I will only use people that have nothing to do with this, to have absolutely a dispassionate, no interest in UFOs, and I typically don't even tell them. When we sent the DNA up for the Star Child, we didn't say, ooh, this is the Star Child, and we think it's this. It's like, you do DNA of, you know, ancient remains in a paleo, you know, era. Here's some DNA. Here's some samples. We'd like you to test it.
That is the only way to go. And so let's hear what Gaia's DNA report says.
Completely human.
Shocking.
Completely human. Yeah, and in fact, it's kind of the same kind of test result that we got back with the Star Child, because the DNA that we submitted, they got the nuclear from, which I'm very proud of, by the way. And
yeah, not easy. Yeah.
Yeah, and there was nothing. There was no phenotypic distinction that even remotely deviated or diverted from human. So there was not even a reason to say, you know, maybe we didn't get the test done, or maybe there was a contaminant, or, you know, there's this phenotypic genetic code or red flag that we might need to test further. They were so completely human. Wow. So
now what about, now I want to talk a little bit about the Star Child skull, but before that, what about, Stephen Greer? I watched his last documentary and he's still saying that most likely that little Atacama baby alien thing is an alien. Now the DNA tested out human.
Yeah, it's, and unfortunately, when we were working on the Star Child skull, I didn't want to stand on Lloyd Pye's shoulders. I wanted to open this case and begin it not where he left off. He was so respected and loved, and we wanted to honor his work as his work.
Yes.
And so we opened the case as brand new set of eyes. It's a cold case, you know, just like any, like police officer would have done. But the first thing I did was take it to the osteology museum because it's a skull. I would like to have a bone specialist or a bone expert tell us, you know, about all the anomalies and all the accusations on the skull. And when we were there, in the back room, and this osteology museum is in Oklahoma City, if anybody gets a chance to go there, the coolest museum ever. In the back room, he just has cabinet after cabinet with tray after tray of all of these, and he pulled out probably 40 of those little bodies that look just like Stephen Greer. They're stillborns. They're aborted.
That one was supposed to be 8 years old, though. You know, I mean, I don't know where they came up with that. The wear on the joints or something.
You see, and this is where we have to start vetting because we have a shocking, shocking revelation that came out with the Star Child skull. We had two of them, actually. But about that baby, well, what test did you do that came out? And where's the data? Where's the thing that I can look at and be convinced that this little baby has lived 8 years of age? I want the science behind it, and yet it's a proclamation. Well, it lived to be 18 because of the lungs. Well, can I see that report? Right? And I also want to vet who did the report and where was this study done and how was that process handled? Because this is what we ran into with the Star Child skull, is not everybody who claimed to be that expert turned out to be an expert. And this is very clear. So it's the same thing with that 8 years old. I want to know how they came up with that. And I want to know all of it, and I want to see it in the reports. If you're saying the wear and tear on the joint, I want to see the joint compared to a normal one. And, you know, this is, we have to be this discerning because these hoaxes, you know, the fairy, remember the little winged fairy hoax and, you know, the Gaia mummies down there. And you remember the headline, DNA proves Nephilim. Coming from Brian Forrester out of South America, it's like, no, it really didn't. It's completely human. So we've just heard this. We have to really start being hard on our investigators, myself included. And we have to really pay attention to what skeptics are saying. They keep us honest, and they let me know where the holes are in my case. Mm-hmm. You know, so if when we decided to reveal all the testing and everything we had done with the Star Child skull, everything's up there. How many times do you see a DNA report that they didn't take away where they had it done, like it's some big secret? We're going to keep our labs to ourselves. You know, it's like, no.
No. Yeah, red flags go everywhere. Just for the listener that is not familiar, I had Lloyd Pye on my show years ago. He passed away, I think, probably 3 years ago or more, right? So Lloyd was a great guy. He had worked with what was called the Star Child skull. I think, I can't remember how that was coined, but, it was something found, well, Chase, you know, the whole background that it was found in a cave, I believe, with another body leaning against it or something like that. But it did have an elongated skull. You can Google it yourself, Star Child, skull and Lloyd Pye. And you will see it come up, very, very odd-looking thing. But end up, you know, the wah, wah, wah music, it was human.
It is. And, you know, Lloyd when he was sick. He was very close with Melanie Young, who is the original owner and was always the owner of the Starchild skull. She made a promise to Lloyd that she would finish the work. And this was something that meant a lot to him when she said it to him, you know, as he was fading and becoming more and more sick. He was terminally ill. And she really took a lot of heat for opening it up, and everybody wanted Lloyd's work to be left alone. And, you know, after 2 years, it took her 2 years to say, you know what, I made that promise to him. He didn't want this to just sit on a shelf. He wanted this finished. And, you know, and in Lloyd's own words, in his own book, his goal, no matter what, where it went, he was bound and determined. He just wanted the truth. No, and...
Oh, pardon me. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, you know, and I think what happened is when we started doing all our investigation and coming up with some of these test results, we would find out that he had the same test results. But why Lloyd would keep pushing forward with the hybrid or the alien narrative was because there were a few experts on his team that were saying this and giving him real evidence. The problem is it was fake. And if you look at the Starchild Project website, they very openly post DNA tests from Trace Labs, Bold Labs, Trace Genetics, Gary Nolan of Stanton University, who also did Greer's Adama right. baby.
Yep.
And those three DNA tests were done. All of them came out mitochondrial only because there was no nuclear extracted. But they knew that the mom was absolutely female and haplogroup C, which is Native American. So there was this fourth geneticist in the report, and this is the where you're getting the FOXP, you know, enigma discussion into this. And there's even these little graphs, but they're not real science lab graphs. They're Photoshop graphs because they're just illustrating what he means. But that's not clear right away, if that makes sense. Well, I kept wondering, well, why is this guy's stuff completely, or this lab, so completely different from everyone else's, including ours? And I'm telling you, Martin, you find out, and I know Lloyd did not know this, you find out that that man is not only not a geneticist, he doesn't have access to a lab, he's a virologist, and he works on Lyme disease. He's a foreign national here on a work visa to study Lyme disease, and that's it. He worked at a university and was eventually terminated for unethical behavior. So, you know, and I know Lloyd didn't know this. I mean, he comes across so legit. Mm-hmm. Like, I was fooled for the, you know, first year. I'm just like, wow, like, and I'm digging into this FOXP and all that. And it doesn't even make sense. Geneticists don't even talk like that. It's not half that vocabulary isn't even in their books. I mean, people are looking at me like, where are you getting this crap? So I vetted the guy behind the science, and this is what we found. And then to find out, I'll even tell you further, the whole DNA from the Nephilim headline, this was this geneticist that was working on that DNA. Remember Melba Ketchum?
Oh, yes, Dr. Melba Ketchum.
And the Bigfoot?
Yeah.
Same DNA guy.
Uh-oh.
All these guys, oh my gosh. And then when I find all this out and this whole trail that he ruined Melba Ketchum. You know, Brian Forrester looks like, you know, a used car salesman and a fool because, you know, the big DNA proves Nephilim. Well, my first question is, well, where'd you get the comparison that you know that's Nephilim? Like,
right.
It's half exactly. Angel, half human. Like, the things coming out. So it really was a big lesson that I really like to talk to other investigators and say, guys, vet your scientist, because not all of them are who they say they are, although they present letterhead. And it's the same guy behind almost every hoax we have.
Unreal.
Yep.
I
would love to name him and call him out. I know exactly who he is. And the only reason I don't, Martin, and you know me, this is killing me. Is because I promised the Starchild Project I would not. And there are private reasons that I promised not to out why they needed me to not out this guy. And But it's killing me. I want to scream his name from the rooftops because he's been lying and really causing a lot of personal trauma with some of these good researchers. Melba was a great veterinarian.
Yes.
He ruined her. Ruined her.
Wow.
Reputation. I mean, you know, who's going to believe it? It's crazy. Terrible.
Well, if you happen to, you know, text me his name on Skype, you know, I might slip and say who it is.
I'll tell you, keep integrity sometimes is hard. It's really, really hard because I've wanted to do that 100 times and it may come out. It won't be for me, but there is somebody else that's kind of, in this whole mix that is just so offended, completely offended because Lloyd believed him. And, Lloyd was not foolish. He was not gullible. But it was, this guy was that good. You know, much like the Gaia mummies, you know, how many people in it, and the minute the tests don't come out, oh, it's a cover up, you know, the government's hiding that they're really, you know, so, you know, there's, so, you can only tell the truth and hope people understand it.
What was, what's that phrase I heard you say again about the science? I love that phrase.
Science doesn't care what we believe.
Yeah, that's right.
I actually have patches made up of that because it's, you know, it's turned, Carrie McClure and I work together on kind of my independent projects. So, you know, I work, very hard and a lot with MUFON, but I also have independent things I like to keep, you know, in my pocket. I don't put all my eggs in anyone's basket, if that makes sense. Yeah. I love MUFON, but I like to do other things too.
Yeah.
So
I think the last time I had you on a full show, you had just come back from Peru. Was it Peru?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that was pretty exciting.
We're still going down there. LA had us down there for a second time and I have to say, Martin, I'm standing there in the back room of one of the most prestigious museums in Peru, with permission from the Ministry of Culture who invited us to take DNA on some of their most anomalous skulls that they picked out and asked us to do.
Amazing.
And the reason, I'm a UFO investigator. I'm standing there like, how did I get here where I'm extracting DNA samples? You know, and most people don't realize there's no certification for evidence collection. The certification and college degrees come with the processing of it. But anybody can pick up evidence. Now, if it's worthy or viable in a lab, you know, you've got to do it right. You have to know what you're doing. But you don't have to You don't have to have a degree. Anybody can do this. And I've just really like it. So I've honed in my skills and really did a lot of training and a lot of study and figured out, you know, how to make this happen. And I now have well over 300. I probably have about almost 400 forensic samples that have produced perfect results from laboratories. It's crazy.
Now, let me ask you something. I've always heard that DNA testing can be very expensive.
It is.
And I don't know if you can even throw a number out there, for instance, what it costs for the Star Child. But who would fund something like that?
We did. Or I better phrase, my husband pays for it. And because I don't work. like, I don't have a job that pays money. This is what I do. And Melanie and Carrie, this is all out of our pocket. The Star Child Project became a corporation and they needed to, because there were books and movie deals and all this and they take donations and, but I've never done that and I don't want to. I think, for an investigator to be paid, somebody wants something in return.
Yes.
And this way, we completely keep the integrity of just dispassionate look, a scientific method, transparent in every single thing, including who exactly touched that sample. We want the public to have everything. So, no, we've never accepted a dime, never. And that's why it took so long to get it done as well, because, you know, I try to sell books. You know, I wrote a book called Admissible with Richard Dolan. You know, just, you try to speak at conferences and, you know, every once in a while, they're very generous with an honorarium. Everything we do goes right back into the next test or, you know, so we try to get out there and do some things to help, but, and we had very generous people. Oh my gosh, Martin, people offered to give us money and we just couldn't take it from the public. We had to maintain that 100%, you know, on our own. We had to. And people were so generous. I mean, imagine turning down a $10,000 offer.
Right.
Chase, I'll pay for the DNA. And we just couldn't do it. We had to do it on our own and scrape pennies and, you know, almost mow lawns for my neighbors. I was getting desperate. I didn't care. I didn't care anymore, but we made it happen. It worked.
I wish our government would do that instead of have the campaign stuff going
on.
Yeah,
right? Exactly.
Be a lot straighter, wouldn't it? Yeah. So this is interesting. It came back after all this time as how many years, how long ago did Lloyd first start working on this?
It was by the time I got the skull, this had been in his camp and in his hands for almost 20 years. He devoted all of his life. He was actually a Bigfoot researcher, and he loved the study of human origins. And once he got the Star Child skull, it just kind of captivates you. And I see how that could happen. I have the skull here.
You have the skull?
One of the first things we did was mold it, because what I wanted was a photograph perfect copy of the Star Child available, because at this point we already knew that this Star Child was at least half Native American. Oh my gosh, Martin, everything stopped. There's huge red lights. Native American remains must be honored, and you
absolutely
cannot display, profit from, transport. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, you know, when we started looking into the laws, we were up against a rock and a hard place.
Serious trouble.
So we wanted to make sure that the Star Child skull was always going to be available to study, at least externally, with other people. I mean, there are Inca bones, there are concussion fractures. There's a lot of things on the Star Child skull that would really provide a lot of information in the future. So we wanted to have that done. So we brought it down to Texas, and Joe Taylor, world premier museum molder and model maker, he does all the big T-Rexes and, you know, everything. And we had him do a photograph perfect. But, yes, it's on my shelf.
Can you actually, for the YouTube watcher, can you actually go grab it? Or is it something that's, why don't you go grab it and bring it over to the camera?
Okay.
I'll change the screen right now for a second. All right, everyone, while she is going to, do that, we're going to be talking in the second hour about the triangle and a few other things, investigation she's working on and all that. And now she's back. So here we go. This is, he didn't do 3D printing. He actually molded this instead.
Yes, and this is photograph perfect. Every detail on here has been meticulously detailed.
Bring it over to the other side a little bit.
There you go.
Yeah, right there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we wanted to make sure it was not only available. Anybody can buy a copy of this Star Child now. But it's mostly, we did it for the research and continued because we were done with it. Without permission from the proper authorities, there was no more extractions that we could legally do. Thank goodness we had them all already. And there's a part of this, when you look at the little skull, Lloyd spending his whole life. I have the copy, Martin, and something about this little skull, it resonates. I mean, you feel something with it, and you know, you start looking and taking DNA. Look at this big cutout of his little skull. And it's just really hard. And I did have to cut one more time. And I took a little piece of, you know, less than a quarter of an inch, but, cause that's all we needed for microscopic work, electron microscopy or the SIMS testing. But Melanie had to leave the room. I mean, it breaks your heart. Because the companion skull that was found with the Star Child skull, anybody that knows anything about human anatomy or osteology, clearly the first thing they see is the many concussion fractures. These guys didn't have it easy.
Right.
And the companion was a female, and I think we counted almost 14.
My goodness. Now, where is the original? Did it go back to where it was found?
It's in the process. When we realized our DNA came back, which we had to wait for ours because we trusted the labs that Lloyd worked, but in the scientific process, it's test, repeat, test, repeat. So we were given the permission to finish the DNA testing, but when the mitochondrial came back, haplogroup C1, see, you know, technology is even greater now, so we even got a better result, definitive, definitely Native American. So the haplogroup for the paternal side, first thing we had done was a sex test. Because we know in a sex test, even though we were certain this was a male, a little boy, he is 5 years old. There's no doubt about that. We knew that a sex test, if it came up male, it would have XY chromosomes, where a female is XX. So if there was a Y chromosome present, then we know at least the dad was at least partially human to pass on that Y chromosome.
Yeah.
So...
Someone mentioned in the chat room, you know, that there's a lot of deformed skulls. What makes this one so outstanding? Didn't have to do with the eye settings and all kinds of different things.
There is, and it's a very bulbous. This is a brachycephaly type. It's a bulbous. It's not really elongated. He actually has flathead syndrome on the back. So but this bulbous, and every single expert that looks at this, first thing they want to say is hydrocephaly.
Right.
And that's where, you know, the liquid gets in the head and it makes it real big. The problem is that it doesn't offer any of the other properties other than it's bulbous. All the other things are missing. So we've determined, even with doctors and archaeologists, that this is he is not hydrocephalic at all. So we did find... The paternal DNA came back haplogroup Q, which is indigenous South America, which absolutely makes sense. So now we have South American and Native American, but he was found in Mexico. So I was working with the Bureau of Indian Affairs out of Washington, D.C. I just called them and worked with them because this was complicated, and it's an international case. And they couldn't help us. We had to go to Mexico. Mm-hmm. Well, we were a little nervous because, you know, there's a lot of antiquity and, you know, elongated skulls and a lot of this stuff out of Peru, is black market. It's huge right now. Mm-hmm. We were kind of afraid to call them and tell them because we didn't want to be arrested by Mexican authorities. But, we did work. And right now where it comes down to is Ruben Uriate. Is working with Melanie Young, the owner, and they're working to repatriate and get him back to the area that, you know, we know he came from, which is Delicias, Chihuahua, and Copper Canyon area.
Wow. Well, that's interesting, and it's another thing that comes to a close, basically. And not that it had much to do with UFOs. You know, the thought was it possibly, you know, alien and all that, you know, another...
I think it's important, you know, there's evidence and ancient writings and even our Bible talks about a hybrid race on this earth. And I'm curious about that. I want DNA. I want to find this hybrid race of giants, or if there is alien hybrids here, we want to know about it. And really digging in and finding more of the DNA has actually led to a lot of progress in the DNA bank as well. So our data is increasing every time we submit more results.
Now, one thing you mentioned earlier, you know, how would we know if it was Nephilim? I think you said, how would we know? Because there are no other samples. What happens in a case like that if they test DNA and if it comes up unusual, they can't just, you know, a scientist isn't going to jump on the bandwagon that it's a hybrid or an alien or something like that? Where do they go when new things happen? Do you know?
It's why those headlines are so offensive. It's, you know, stop teasing and you know, the public's counting on us. You know, when you have names and you're known out here and you make a proclamation, you know, we have to be better than that because there are going to be some in the public that are going to believe us. What happens with that DNA is exactly what we're finding with Stephen Greer's. There is some DNA that can't be identified. It doesn't mean it's alien. It just means it's not in our bank yet, or it's corrupt and it comes out as an unknown because it's so corrupted they can't identify it. And of course that doesn't mean it's, you know, alien either. It just means that something corrupted that genome. So what we're finding, it is just testing and more testing. But I have to wonder, Martin, because we're finding, I've done the Bob White medal. Remember the UFO case with Bob White where that kind of cone and this medal ejected from a UFO?
Right, yeah.
And then there was another medals case I did with Benny Foggin.
Was that the trees?
This one was another medal that was dropped in a driveway after an alleged UFO. Mm-hmm. And but there are several of these types of anomaly. We're finding in the metals, they all have pretty much the same type of alloy you would expect in metal that could transverse space. And the universe is made up of all kind of the same stuff. The moon would have more helium, where here it's a rare earth mineral, but we still have it. It's not exotic. So now I have to wonder, when it comes to biology, are we the only kind of biology that would progress into intelligence? Are we closer to a gray than we think we are? You know, where does our DNA come from? If we were created in a likeness, or we were manufactured as a Sumerian belief system would tell us, or even if it's biblical, what does alien DNA look like? So the fact that these are coming back human may just not be that big of a deal until we get alien DNA, or we get Nephilim, or we get Bigfoot, or, you know, this little Stephen Greer does show anomaly. It's better. We're getting better at the facts. When this first came out, it was just unknown. It made sense that people would freak out. I would have freaked out. We have a DNA genomes that came back unknown. Now we understand that it will get an unknown reading if part of that genome was corrupt, because they just can't identify it. So, you know, we're getting better at this. And for me, every time we solve a case, it's a success. I've been doing this since 1994. Of course I wanted a friggin' alien. I want a hybrid. I want a piece of metal. I want that crunchy, you know, and it expands. And first thing I do is call Alejandro and I'll be, right, call Alejandro and say, I'm coming to Congress with, you know, memory metal. We're showing the world.
Yeah.
But when it's all said and done, of course this is what I want. So there's a huge disappointment. But I'm always satisfied that we did our job right, and that when we find the truth, we can now take that lead out of our pursuit. Okay, that's not legit anymore. Let's go on to the next, really next great lead we can follow to the truth. So to me, it's a process of elimination. We're doing our job. We're doing it right. We're meeting admissibility. We're transparent so that anybody in the public can say, wow, I'm interested in what a Sims test looks like. And they'll know the lab, exactly who did it, what their process was, and every single word they wrote in their report. We have to do it this way.
Now, going back to the, you said it was someone that was working on Lyme disease, and they were calling themselves, you know, a scientist. Isn't that fraud? Can't someone go to jail for doing something like that, or is it? Or can anyone do something like that?
Again, he was doing it off the grid, and that was part of the agreement. So knowing that he worked at a university, and not a legit lab. So if this was somebody from Paleo DNA Lab up in Canada that we use, which is a legitimate, you know, very successful, you know, highly credited lab, oh, heck yeah, we could sue them. But unfortunately, and, you know, and we're all poor because we're all paying for these stupid tests. I mean, who could afford a lawyer, right, to even go after them in the first place? But he's also a foreign national. And, you know, when you know the whole story, it gets even more disgusting, Martin. It's just like, you know, I, again, like, please let me run into this guy somewhere on the street corner. And everybody stand back for just 2 minutes.
That's right. You know self-defense. You're trained, aren't you? Yeah.
I think at this point, I wouldn't even have to be. I think just the rage, you know, it's the same thing with, like, Richard Doty. You know, people that just are so abusive when, you know, the heart's in the right place and we're just looking for mysteries. And it's a UFO reality that it's done, guys. We know there are UFOs. We answered that question 10 years ago. Asked, answered. What we're looking for now is who are they and what do they want? I don't even do lights in the sky anymore. They're always only going to be a light in the sky.
Yeah.
We can never say that's a mothership or, oh, that's, you know, the guys from Pallades. You know, it's always going to be a light in the sky. I don't want to waste my time anymore. I want evidence. I want evidence cases that produce something, whether it's trace evidence, landing marks, something that we can now test. And our possibilities are just doubling every year on what we can do, what we can get. Remember the little tiny microscopic balls that they found on a weather balloon. So they're testing the stratosphere and collecting these little debris or this thing. They come back and there's all these little pits, and this guy's like, what is that? And he's pulling out these little metal, microscopic, tiny little metal, about the size of a hair thickness. And they open it up. These are PhDs. These are like the best minds in this physical science. They open them up and they're finding genetic material and DNA in them.
Right.
Wait, what? So they're finding that on the stratosphere. Then we find out that there's an alleged UFO landing sighted by a bunch of people on a train in Russia. And when they go to the landing site, they find little balls with that same genetic material in it. So all of a sudden I'm freaking out thinking, oh my gosh, we have something new to test. Every time a witness tells us that something's close to the ground or has landed, we have to take soil samples, whether there's trace evidence, physical evidence, because now we're looking for these little metal balls. Because if they're present, it came through the stratosphere. It wasn't a plane or a, you know, Chinese lantern.
Mm-hmm.
So science is really catapulting UFO investigations forward and at warp speed. We have to pay attention to what's breaking and what's being patented. We knew EM technology was possible before the announcement came out, and we don't even have the confirmation yet about EM propulsion, but we know it's coming. We knew 6 years ago. Why? We're following the patents. Because you know those companies are peeing on their bushes. They're going to want their credit for their technology, right? So they're going to patent these so people can't take them or steal them. And, you know, and it's just, we got them. We got them, Martin. We're paying attention and we're doing our job.
Right. Now, these little metal balls with genetic material, that's almost sort of a sign for the panspermia that you know, the possibilities of that going all
and
through the universe.
You're absolutely right, and that's exactly what these scientists believe this is it's spreading life. They're not saying that it's DNA from a human. It could be a different species of animal, a fish, you know, all sorts of things. They don't know what it is. This is brand new discovery. It's been a couple years now, but the fact that we're finding it in other places and just how weird, you know, I love this. Something that had absolutely nothing to do with UFOs is turning out to be one of our next big pursuits and something we're looking at. And why I love it so much is it's testable.
Yeah. It's not fleeting. It's right there.
Right.
Now, I know you've been working on the Crystal Mine case. I don't know if you want to go into that now. Would you like to talk about that? And
sure.
Tell people a little. I had never heard of it before. So can you talk about what it is?
The Crystal Mine case is a crystal mine that is absolutely experiencing phenomena in Mena, Arkansas. And this case first came at us. I can't talk about the original report that MUFON had done. I'm under non-disclosure because not only is MUFON getting ready to release the final report from our investigation, but it's also being featured on Expedition Unknown with Josh Gates. It's the last episode of his four-part series looking for extraterrestrials. So this will be in October. So I can't talk about that part, but what I can talk about is the ongoing activity and events and, you know, just these strange things. And when we got down there, of course, one of the things we do is a lot of the background and realized all of the strange light reports coming out of MENA. And some of these are Brown Mountain or Marfa-type sightings. It's historic all the way back to the late 1900s.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So when you're having this, and of course, as UFO investigators, you know, we don't mark our cars and have UFO hunter on my license plate because when I pull up to somebody's house, they don't may not want their neighbor who's driving by or walking and see that, you know, and know that they're reporting a UFO or something. We're very discreet. So I couldn't really canvass. We can't, you know, just start knocking on all the doors of MENA like, hey, you guys have any experiences? But what we've learned to do is hold town hall meetings. And so there's an investigation team with KGRA Radio. I thought that was great. Here you have a radio network with, you know, Linda Moulton Howell and Richard Dolan and L.A. Marzulli and, you know, me and Micah Hanks and all these people. Why don't we start looking into some of this anomaly and accept cases and get out there and do it ourselves? And so that's what we're starting to do. And we're going to go out, back out to MENA and actually have a town hall meeting and invite people to come and tell us what they know. Bring your evidence. Do you have photos? And let's start finding out what's going on in this location in our country, which, by the way, is 37th parallel.
Oh, really? How about that?
Yes. Right?
Hey, how do you get the word out that you're going to have this town hall type meeting?
It was something that we wanted to make sure we didn't come across. We're professional, right? So the first thing we did was Race Hobbs, program director over at KGRA, called the university, and they had a beautiful lecture hall that holds about 300 people and offered it to us. And we called all the local newspapers and the radio stations, putting word out. We're going on social media. Of course, the witnesses themselves that we have already spoken to, because I've been to this investigation twice, this site twice now, and I've spent almost 15 days. And, you know, Race Hobbs was with me on the first one. So, you know, we made some connections, talked to other people. They're putting flyers out, getting the word out. But it's a small community. They already know that, you know, me and Josh Gates were out there not too long ago. So they're very curious about the rest of the story. And, of course, we couldn't be in a better position by we purposefully went to the college because we want these younger kids to get the bug. We want them to start, yeah, joining us. And they're interested. We know that. They can't get enough alien and paranormal stuff. Come and talk to us. See what's going on. And let's get you joined and move on and listening to podcasts and doing some homework and, you know, getting out in the field and doing this. We don't want the Kardashians that want to be famous for nothing.
Yeah.
We want the people that are, you know, legitimately really struck by the passion and the anomaly and that want to join us. We have got to get these younger kids trained and, you know, have the kind of history that we have, you know, coming in. And so we're hoping to inspire some of that by holding this purposefully at a university.
Has anyone seen any type of structured craft, what they consider structured craft in that area?
Not part of the reports we've personally taken to MENA. However, there's a lot of light anomaly, not so much a structured craft. There are other things going on.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I know there's floating rocks and things.
Yeah.
Is that true, or is that a rumor?
I haven't seen levitating rocks and rocks that seem to move. And what I can tell you are the witnesses are credible. So we're not really sure. And there, you know, I had a lot of scrutiny on these two because, you know, it's a crystal mine and all sorts of things can happen. I believe that a lot of some of the things that are going on is absolutely a physical reality. It's physics. It's something natural that's occurring. You have a aquifer, Oklahoma UFO paranormal group, Dick and Marilyn Carlson's group. I asked her if they'd go out there and they'd like to, you know, investigate. And the reason I do that is now you have a different team. What did you guys come up with? Are we corroborating good evidence? Did you guys find something I didn't? So I like working with other groups. We're not in competition with them. We're in partnership. I really insist on working that way. So that was pretty cool. Finding aquifers, you learn so much about crystals or, you know, things about cases when you're in different regions. Arkansas crystals are the most powerful in the world. You can only find this type of crystal in Arkansas or Brazil. The most powerful. It's credited with winning World War II because our communications were so much better because of the strength and clarity and quality of Arkansas crystals. It's amazing. Yeah, they grow differently and the anomaly. So this is something they're already getting a lot of attention. There's a lot of investigators and researchers going down and they're opening and letting them. I wish I could talk more about what happened on the initial sighting because it's drastic and it scared them enough. They shut the mine down. And even though it's a public mine that they charge money, it's their livelihood for people to come in and dig crystals. They shut it down until they knew it was safe because there were big effects. So, they weren't in it for the money. It was pretty cool. This is going to be a good case. This is a big one. It's a good one, trust me, yeah.
And what are some other things you're working on? Do you have anything you're actively researching right now?
Right now, really focusing back because I'm actually leaving next Wednesday, going to Utah, speaking at Paracon in Salt Lake City. And then we're doing an investigation up somewhere in Utah in an undisclosed location. Again, I'm under non-disclosure, I can't say. But then we're going back to MENA and doing another big investigation and doing this town hall. And then I'm going to take November and December off.
Ah, good for you.
I'm going to try. I really have little grandkids I love to see. I'm going to be gone almost 2 weeks. So this month I'll be home maybe, you know, 11 days. The month of August I was home for 9. So I need to be home for a little bit. So I'm just going to take some time off. Already booking up. I'm doing the MUFON cruise with Holiday Travel. And we've got a conference cruise. I believe it's already sold out in January. In February, you and I are going to be at Congress.
Yes.
Can't wait. My favorite conference out of all of them. I love Congress. And but I'm going to be working because I love Alejandro and I love what he's doing. And he works so hard. And I would love to help him out any way I could. And I'm going to be speaking in Ozarks again, Ozark Mountain UFO Conference in Eureka Springs.
I heard
already booked for that.
I've heard people talk about that conference saying it's really, really good.
It's the second best conference. You know, my heart goes with Congress because I have a lot of reasons to say that, mostly because I'm so fond of Phoenix MUFON and, you know, the group they have down there. I'm so impressed with the work they're doing and the people that they're doing it with. They're just the best group down there. But Ozark, you know, this is Dolores Cannon's daughters that have picked up their mom's passion and, you know, drive to continually have these conferences. This conference is, I mean, how many year anniversary did they just have? I think it was 30.
Wow. Yeah.
30 years. And it's a huge conference. It's another big one. It's a big conference.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. You know, I've had up on the message board quite a bit. Oh, we have someone calling in. How about we take a call? Here's a call right now. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Can you say your first name and where you're calling from?
Bobby from North Carolina.
Hey, Bobby. How are you?
Good, good. Doing good. Weather is hot, but it's soon going to turn cool. Chase is great. Love hearing her again. Right. I've heard her on a lot of different shows. But I want her to know that everybody wants to hear about the triangle.
Is that it?
And it's Bobby, right?
Yep.
Thank you so much for calling in, Bobby. And I kind of feel like it's overdone, but I do love Martin Willis, and I do appreciate so much that you're listening, so I will tell that story.
It's a great story. Everybody loves it, and several people in here have asked about it in the past 30 minutes.
Okay, so and
Yeah.
It was really an epic event, and it's been quite a few years later, and I still struggle with some of the things that I may not have even realized when, you know, I first started talking about it, and you were one of my first shows. One of the reasons I love your show, Martin, it was when I first started doing the whole little radio thing, you were the first host that asked me probably the smartest, nicest questions, and it was, you were so sincere with the honesty, and I just never forgot, like, you were just my favorite show.
Aww.
So, yes.
That's sweet.
So
thank
the
you.
Nostalgia, but this was an event that happened to us in 2010, and I was in MUFON at the time, and I was living in Millington, Tennessee, which is right outside of Memphis. My husband was active duty at the time, and we literally got a call from, and it was a Star Team case, and the witness was telling me that it. They were seeing these strange lights and lights in the sky, orange orbs. They were actually chasing them down these, you know, country dirt roads. He was telling me things like his children were afraid to go to their rooms at night, and, you know, just things were ramping up, and he was getting very nervous. This was also the time of that epic big flood where it flooded Nashville to Memphis. So our initial meeting was pushed back almost 2 weeks until the waters receded enough to where I could even drive there. So a lot of the roads were still closed. But I did get a call. I was supposed to go, I believe, on a Saturday. And I get a call. I think it was a Thursday night. Please don't quote me on that one. But it was a couple of days earlier than me going out. And he's like, oh, my gosh, Chase, already things are happening. And this is exactly what starts when all, you know, when the big stuff comes, you know, the triangles. And I was so stunned when I heard him say this because that's the one thing he hadn't reported yet. And I've been talking to this guy for a few weeks already.
Can you,
and,
just 1 second. I don't think you mentioned this. Pardon me for interrupting. But this is also someone that is well known. A celebrity of sorts.
Yes.
I can't really go into details, but you did tell me, which is pretty amazing that has he ever gone public with it? Do you know?
No. And truthfully, every once in a while, I'll get a, you know, a text or whatever. We were talking constantly during the event, or the report process. Even after this evening, we stayed in touch for a little bit because there was so much, more investigation we needed to do. Then, things started slowing down a little bit, and it turned into, you know, like text message, you know, every week or so, like, have you heard anything? No, not yet, blah, blah, blah. Then it just, now what it is maybe, I don't know, about every 6 months or so, I just get a text, hey, you still there? And I just text back, yep. You still good? He's like, yep. And I think it's his way of just making sure I still have the same phone number and I'm still there in case one day. But, yeah, this witness is extremely well known. He is, very credible, and he did not want to go public. He had small children at the time, and he feared, living in this small town, and he did that on purpose for privacy. He didn't want his kids to be, you know, the kids being teased growing up in school that, you know, their dad saw a UFO and, you know, very private. his privacy probably meant as much to him as anything else he protected, including his children. In fact, he made a comment to me that I'll never forget when I asked him, you know, have you heard your neighbors talking, or are there whispers or anybody mentioning that they're seeing anything? And he kind of leans up on the fence and he says, you know, Chase, around here, people mind their own business, and we don't like people who don't. I got it. I got it, guys, right? So it was kind of that mentality. The other thing that's, before I finish what happened to us that evening, it's also important to know that this is so rural Tennessee that these guys don't call 911. They handle it. 911 is something that they call after, you know, clean up the mess or whatever they need to do. These guys take care of whatever they need to out there. When we first got there, there was a point when we got to the cornfield that he pulls out like a big old shotgun. And apparently the look on my face was like, you know, you have to remember, there's two females. We just jump in a car and we go to people's houses. We don't know anything about them. It's like kind of silly or dangerous almost. But, you know, here we are. We jump in the guy's truck and we go down to the woods and in this big cornfield. He pulls out this shotgun and he looked at me and he said, no. He says, Chase, we have a problem with coyotes around here. So in case any of these should come up, I got us covered. This guy never said run, get into the truck. He already had a plan because he knew of a possible danger. You know, it's just, this is what they do. So anyway, I jump in the car. When he said triangle, I just ran. I wasn't even sure all the roads were clear, didn't even think about that. But I called the other MUFON investigator that was assigned to secondary with me. And I went and picked her up, and we were on the road. I was gone. And by the time we got up to the house, it was already starting, you know, to be dawn. Twilight. So it was starting to get dark, not quite yet. We pull up in the driveway, and he immediately takes us kind of to the edge of where his yard, and the yard goes down on a big slope, but you could kind of see this big area. And he goes, this will be a great view. And all of a sudden he goes, oh, look, there's those little ones popping up. And I look up and the other investigator look up, and sure enough, it took me a minute, for my eyes to adjust and to see exactly what he's talking about. But then it was clear as day. You know, there's these little tiny lights in the sky about the size of the stars, except they're moving and they're coming together and they're forming shapes and kind of doing things almost as a unit, and then splitting up and almost performing for us. And if you got tired of this group, there's about four more starting to gather, doing the same thing in the skies. Well, Martin and Bob, who called, Bobby, I think that was his name.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm excited at this point because this is friggin' awesome. I'm just like, you know, we got our little tablets out, looking at, you know, satellites. Where are the satellites? Where are the planes? You know, with, you know, all the usual suspects, even though clearly this is not what it was, we still had to do our job and document that these things were not there. The ISS is not in the area at the time, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I'm just freaking out. I'm looking. I'm like, my heart's just pounding. This is a good night already. And then he suggests that he has a cornfield down the road. It's about 100 acres. It's huge, huge cornfield. Again, this is April, so the corn is, you know, just those little things that come up maybe 4 or 5 inches. So it was real pliable. We weren't going to hurt any crops, so we could go down there. And that's what we did. We jumped in his truck, and he took us to the middle of this great big cornfield. I have to tell you, I'm from Rhode Island. I've never seen a cornfield that big in my life. It was like, first thing I asked him is, you own all this? This is all your corn? And who needs this much corn? Like, but anyway, it was fun. But we kind of set up like a little table, and I just had to have a few things set up because I do like my equipment. So it wasn't too long, and all of a sudden, you know, he kind of gets excited. He goes, oh my gosh, here it comes, Chase. This is exactly why I wanted you to come here. And we look up, and he's pointing. And sure enough, I see a light, and it's bigger than the little kind of starlights we had seen before or witnessed before. And it's this, just this white light. And at first, you're not really sure what it's doing, But then it was clear that it was kind of getting closer. And then all of a sudden, two more show up, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, there's three of them. This is so cool. And, you know, I'm looking at the other witness. She's kind of looking at, the other investigator. She's looking at me, and we're just almost dumbstruck at this point because here's these three lights. Clearly, I knew already this is no plane, at least not yet. And I kind of had the feeling that this, you know, something's coming. So, and not in like a bad way or anything. It was just like, oh my gosh. And sure enough, as it got closer, you realize these weren't three individual lights, although they were, but they were connected to one object. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is a triangle. And then you could see very faintly a red light underneath it, not directly underneath it like the Belgium. This one was forward. It was more forward, like ridiculously way forward. But sure enough, here it comes, and it just slowly came over our heads. It was just smooth. It's really hard to describe how it moved. It wasn't really floating or being towed, it wasn't flying, it wasn't gliding. It's hard to even find the words. It moves so differently. And at this point, I'm trying to pick up equipment, and I'm kind of doing it like this, where you kind of got your hands down because you don't want to take your eyes off it. You're almost afraid if you don't look at it, it goes away.
Yeah.
You know, like you turn away and then it's gone. You know, you hear that a lot. But, you know, I'm trying to pick up my cameras. I believe I had four cameras at the time, all different makes and models, and none of them. Every time I tried to get a shot, you know, it was just dead. I mean, dead. Like the little thing wasn't clicking or anything. And I'm picking up my trifield meter, and I had a couple other things out there, you know, weather. I had a little weather thing that had like a little fan in it, you know, where you kind of pull it up to see what a wind speed was. Oh my gosh, nothing was working, and I was very, very frustrated. I remember feeling like just more than frustrating. Like I really wanted to just toss this stuff because it's right here. I'm an investigator. I'm right here. It's right there, and we're missing it. We're missing it. Sure enough, this triangle goes directly over our heads. It goes right over that cornfield, and never changes altitude, speed, nothing.
How fast would you guess it was going?
That one was a hard one. It was so big.
You don't know the distance either.
Mm-mm. Well, I know that when we put our, if I were to hold my arm straight up in the air and open a magazine and look at the object, the magazine would not have covered that object.
So it was a big, probably
huge,
very big. Now, did you feel anything? A lot of times people talk about they feel like a vibration, they'll feel like a pressure or something like that. Did you feel anything at all?
No, I don't remember, other than just, you know, your heart's pounding because, you know, this thing was huge. It was a little intimidating, but in an awestruck way. And I think I was just more excited because at this point, again, I've been doing this since 1994. And this was the coolest thing I've ever seen so far. I've seen a lot of things that aren't supposed to exist. This was the coolest by far. It was also the way this moves is there's just something about it that you just know it's not ours. It can't be. It's just weird. It's different. The atmosphere changes, but I don't remember hearing buzzing or feeling anything other than OMG. Uh-huh. I can't believe it's right there, and I can't take a photo. So other than that, I'm not sure, really, if I'd even notice if anything else was going on at that point. I do know it was kind of a weird quiet, but other than that, but we just kept our eyes on it, and I still kept trying to take photographs and video, and as it's going away, I did manage to get off. I ended up with a little over 600 photographs, because when it did start working, you could still see a little bit of the back end of it. And I did get some. And, but it's, you know, again, lights in the sky. That's all you can see. And, they haven't been able to determine it is anything other than strange lights in the sky. So at least got that evidence. But, you know, here it is right here. Well, anyway, I was so frustrated because of the equipment and, reached down because I was going to, you know, change the batteries because at this point I'm thinking it's a battery drain, which is something we hear about all the time in paranormal and UFO investigations. But when I picked my camera up, the little red light was, you know, ready. You know, I'm just like, wait, what? So I start taking photos and sure enough, you know, they're working just fine. And everything is back online. My tri-field is lighting up when I pick it up and, you know, turn low buttons. But I had just decided that I was going to change the batteries anyway because, you know, ridiculously detailed. And if we already had a problem, let me just change them. And on a tri-field meter, they have the little screws in back where you need a little screwdriver to take the battery cover off. And I was doing that. And it was during this time where I just remember feeling just real quick, kind of like, you know, I think almost like someone's watching me. I guess I don't even remember feeling anything. I just remember turning around and saying, hey guys, does anybody else feel like you're being watched? Hmm. And I think I referred to, I don't mean like being watched from up there. And I don't even think I finished my statement. And I just remember this physical, something very physical just pounds into you. And I was completely aware that every single cell in my body was in not fight or flight, absolute terror. Wow. Every cell in my body, not just your stomach or you're nervous or you feel fight or flight. It is horrendous. I know this is going to sound crazy, which is what most UFO witnesses start out saying anyway, but the longer it goes on, the more I forget the details about how I felt at the time. But I just remember it wasn't painful. I just remember being absolute in terror. And I just remember I turned and started running. When I did, I noticed that, the witness and the other investigator turned at the exact same time and was running too.
Did you just leave your camera equipment and everything or did you grab it?
Yeah. No. Everything was, I just remember I turned and I started running.
Wow.
And it's funny because I also remember the whole time when I'm running and we're in it. Remember the waters had just receded. So it's kind of soft out there and I have bad ankles. Like they kind of roll on me all the time and I'm always worried about, you know, twisting because it's, you know, but I'm running and I'm really going pretty fast. And I remember seeing this light go, you know, I'm just watching this light. I'm just following this light. It's just going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then all of a sudden, bam, I hit what felt like this brick wall and came practically to a dead stop. And what happened was I ran into the witness who I didn't see had stopped in front of me. And that strange light I kept watching that's going left and right, left and right, left and right, was he had a flashlight in his hand. Mm. And as he's running, this is the light. But that's, I just remember being focused on this stupid little light and hit him. And I knocked him a good one, I'll be honest with you. And I just remember hearing him say, what the F is that? And he dropped his left hand. I remember the flashlight being in his left hand. Sorry for the coughing, everybody. The left hand, and he just said, what the F is that? Threw his hand out to his side. He looked over, and not 6 feet from us, here's this being. Just standing there.
Not moving or anything.
Nothing.
I remember you describing this, so like little stick legs or something like that.
I remember being focused in. I'm not sure if that's where the flashlight was. It took many months after that we realized, because I was so worried. His legs were abnormally, like a normal size 3.5 foot, you know, with, you know, kind of that normal body that you would expect, but his legs were thinner than the pen. And that's what I remember. And it just didn't make sense. It was one of those sights you were seeing where I was kind of focused and I saw his face and then I just remember his legs. And now we realize it was the angle of the flashlight that I was just seeing bits of them. Oh. You know, the other legs were shaded.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, and next thing I know, we were running.
Did you scream? I mean, what happened when you all saw this being?
Nothing.
And did it react at all?
Nothing. And that's something, when we were going through the testimony after and reporting what we saw to state director and the other people that came out, we kept saying, like, how does it go from dark in the woods? You know, remember, there's no street lights anywhere. There's no town close. This is as dark as it gets. It's that kind of sky you dream of looking at, just full of stars and activity. How do you go from dark, dark, dark to one of these big, big, you know, halogen flashlights directly in your face and not a flinch, nothing? I described the being when I saw it, that it was obviously biological. How I know that, I can't say other than, you know, it was just biological. And yet, it reacted with nothing, almost mechanical. So, but yeah, no one screamed, nobody said nothing. In fact, I don't remember hearing anything. And I was just running again. And so was a witness. And we got to his truck. All of us jumped in the truck, pulled out of the cornfield pretty aggressively, by the way. He was making no haste. And we got to his driveway, and we all piled out. Nobody saying anything. It took a moment. And I just really remember, I think I was the first one who said something, and I think I kind of giggled and said, "What the blank just happened?" Like, what? Like, and I'm like, why do we run? I, you know, that was something. And at this point, I don't even know when the fear left, because by the time we got back to the driveway, that terror, I mean, to even talk about it now with you, which isn't as much detail as probably we did the first time, because I'm trying to get through the story before we run out of time, but, you know, honestly, even this little bit, you just feel, it's just, I don't feel that terror again, but there's enough of a memory where I just don't want to go there again. Sure. You know, it was brutal, that kind of terror. And the only way I could describe it is every little cell of my body knew it had its own huge terror. Now, so anyway, I remember saying that we just needed to call the state director. At this point, this night's already ridiculous. Nobody gets everything in one night. That was probably my biggest concern going home. I just remember thinking, you know, and not cussing, which I did in the car. I won't hear, but it was like BS. Nobody gets everything in one night. What is going on? What just happened out there? And why did we run? Not a runner. The other investigator, I wouldn't call her a runner either. I didn't know her that well. She was just a MUFON investigator that was available. But I can tell you that witness wasn't a runner. Why did we run? One thing I can tell you that all of us came out and said was it was controlled. We had absolutely no control over what we were doing. What we did was something we had no control over. Wow. I can tell you that right now. There is no way. I don't know why we ran. Nobody was scared. And I think it's a third interview and disposition we were giving to the investigators. They kept asking us, well, did somebody say, what is that? Or how did you know the being was out there? And I'm like, I didn't. I didn't know if anyone else did. In fact, it was 2 weeks before I even realized that the other investigator was already in front of that being when she turned and started running. The only two that saw it was me and the witness. So we really, because when we got back to the driveway, I just remember thinking, we can't talk about this. We cannot, the three of us cannot say one more word about what just happened down there until our testimonies are taken. Right. And sure enough, that happened the very next morning. We called the state director, you know, he put a red alert out on, and, you know, people were freaking out trying to get to that place because, you know, after hearing what happened. But I will tell you that we were back in that cornfield 30 minutes later because, again, I don't know when that fear left in that car ride. I just know that by the time I got to a driveway, I realized, oh, I don't feel that terror. Like, and wait, what just happened? And we were right back down there. And I just remember his cousins were a little curious, and they drove down, and they were standing on the side of the cornfield for a little bit while we were out there. I didn't want them in the cornfield because we were in an investigation. And I couldn't help but think, did you guys come down maybe to see my reaction or to see why, you know, we didn't see your little eight? Like, did they put that out there? Was this a prop? Because it didn't move. There was nothing. And the first thing we did when we got back to the cornfield was retrace all our steps. I could see everywhere we had been. I could even see where I hit that witness. There was nothing around there.
No footprints?
No. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't even footprints of somebody walking out to place something out there. That whole area was completely untouched. Thank goodness. And of course I had to get photos of that because, you know, that it was something that wasn't there that proved somebody didn't put that being out there as a joke or a mannequin or, you know, To this day, I still go back to that case every once in a while. I love working with people like Yvonne Smith and, you know, people that understand what happens when you see something. I don't consider myself an experiencer or a contactee because I call it the 1 second that changed everything. Because Martin, when I hit the witness, he said, "What's that?" And when my eyes followed the light, and when I saw that being, it was literally 1/1002. That's it. We were already running again.
Yeah. We're right near the end of the show here. Did you, once you had given your testimony, did you talk to the witness about the being? Have you spoken to him about it? And did he have the same experience you did?
Yes. I could tell you, we actually, the only time all of us were together, except for the witness, but the state director, the other MUFON investigator, and we had his handwritten testimony at the time. We were at a small conference in Tennessee, and the state director came up and absolutely said, all three of the statements are almost exactly alike. They, you know, there was nothing about one saying this that contradicted the other. The only thing we were all over the place on, and none of us got it right, and we were all so far apart, was how high that triangle was.
Right.
We were all over the place on our numbers. I mean, yeah. We weren't even close.
Yeah. Chase, we're at the end. I'm sorry to say.
I know.
That went really fast. Can you please tell the audience when you have your show and how they can watch it?
I actually listen
to it.
Yeah, I actually turned over Fate Magazine to another host. And, so I'm not doing radio at the time. I'm really devoting all my time into, the investigations and.
Sure. All right. Sorry about that. In your,
No, that's okay.
Your website is your name.
It is just my name, ChaseKletsky.com. And, if you guys wanted to look at some of the other investigations we're doing independently that I do with Carrie McClure, that's the Field Reports, all one word, thefieldreports.com. And Star Child Skull and all our work's right there. I'm on Facebook, Twitter.
All right.
You know, my phone number's everywhere. Nobody cares.
Okay. All right, Chase. It's been a pleasure once again. Always great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Bye, guys.
All right. All right, everyone. Thanks for either supporting the show or watching us on YouTube or listening to the podcast elsewhere. I really appreciate it. And next week we'll be back with Caroline Corey. And she was scheduled to be on last week, but she ended up traveling, so had to reschedule her. And don't forget, we are going to be at Shag Harbor. I'm going to be up there with Jordan Bonaparte from the Nighttime Podcast. I'm meeting him there in Shag Harbor, actually Friday evening. So I'm on my way north tomorrow. So that show you can watch either on YouTube or on podcastufo.com. That is 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time this coming Saturday, the 30th. And it should be fun. All right. Thanks so much. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.